Good morning. It's good to see everyone here this morning. So Tommy alluded to the title of my lesson of Butterflies, Penguins in the Eye. So most of you are probably aware that I am on Facebook, and as probably with most websites and social media, they have algorithms. And so they try to determine what's of interest to this individual. What can we do to get him to come back? And so for me, it's butterflies, penguins, and the eyes. So hopefully we'll look at this morning and see what we can learn and how we can grow from this information. So if we start by looking at the life cycle of the monarch butterfly. The butterfly starts out, and they're all laid on the underside of a milkweed. All monarch butterflies are laid on the underside of a milkweed. And they'll be there for about 3 to 5 days. That's how long it takes for them to hatch. And so from there, they become these caterpillar-eating machines. And so for the next 10 to 14 days, that's all they do is they eat milkweed. It's the only thing that they eat. And they start out at somewhere between a 16th and an 1/8 of an inch long. And in those next 14 days, they become almost 2 inches long, and their mass will increase by almost 2,000 times. Constant eating, just constant eating. And the only time that they stop is when it becomes time to molt. So some interesting things about milkweed is the fact that to pets, livestock, and even people, they can cause digestive issues. They can affect your heart rate. In extreme cases, they can even cause death. But these little larvae, that's the only thing they eat. And this constant eating allows them to grow, but then if there's a predator around, it becomes an unpleasant taste to them and potentially poisonous to its predator. So this increase in size would be like if you have a baby, you have a newborn, in the next 2 weeks, it eats enough to become the size of a school bus and weigh 8 tons. That's a lot of eating. That's a lot. From there, they become into a chrysalis state, where they come into this metamorphosis before they become a butterfly. And this will occur somewhere between 8 and 15 days. They will do this in this last picture. That's them hanging. And then finally, they'll become an adult butterfly, and they'll live for somewhere between 2 to 6 weeks. Now, these are the summer butterflies, and this becomes important later. They will live for somewhere between 2 to 6 weeks, so an average of about 4. So in this picture here, the one on the left, the one with the larger veins is the female. The one on the right with the smaller veins and the two little dots that look like eyes, those are the males. And so there's a very distinct difference between the male and the female. And so this will happen for about 4 or 5 generations. This same sequence will happen as they will lay the eggs on the underside of a milkweed. They'll turn into this larva. They'll turn into a butterfly. And again, it happens for about 4 or 5 generations. Very short period of time. You're talking 4 to 6 months as all this takes place. But on the 4th or 5th generation, so essentially the last one of the year, the butterflies, when they become adult, they live for 8 to 9 months. And they call them super generations of these butterflies. So this becomes important to the monarch butterfly's survival. So first of all, the monarch butterfly lives in North America, United States, Canada, but they can't handle the cold in the winter. So it becomes important that they have to travel. So this 4th or 5th generation, which lives essentially 8 or 9 times longer then all the generations before it starts to make a travel. So they can't handle the cold, and so therefore they must migrate to somewhere where it's warmer. And so somewhere in late August to October, as the days start getting shorter and the weather starts getting colder, the butterflies start to travel. So from here in North America and the United States and Canada, they will travel to Mexico in a town, near a town, and I'm going to mutilate this, but I'm going to try anyways. Anguineo Ochean, which is just west of Mexico City. So this is going to be approximately 2,000 to 3,000 mile travel for butterfly. So if you look at that picture there on the right, you'll notice that there's a very distinctive line drawn. So those butterflies that are east of the Rockies will travel down to this place in Mexico. And the butterflies west of the Rockies will travel to Southern California. And so scientists have come up with a GPS tracker about the size of a grain of rice. And so they have put it on a number of these butterflies when they're in their summertime to see where they travel to. And so you can see a very distinct from the Rockies east. So that's where they're traveling. And so as we look at this, this is not just a few. And so it's also not just from one region. And so east of the Rockies is somewhere around 2 million square miles. And so all of these butterflies travel south. In the late 90s, they converged into one area, and they estimated that there was over 300 million of these butterflies that showed up in Mexico. It made this trip. So for them to make this trip, they have to travel somewhere around 50 to 100 miles a day. And they fly somewhere between 800 to 1,200 feet. So they're about 1,000 feet in the air, so we can't see them as they go. But there's a lot of them traveling. We can't see it, but they're heading that direction. And so they do this, and they're heading for an Onomer fir tree that's in this location in Mexico. So some interesting things that we need to note here is, one, you have a generation that has never been there. They don't have their parents nor their grandparents have ever been there, but they know where to head to. And it's these specific kind of trees that they're looking for. These trees that will have a canopy, and they will actually get underneath it because they can handle the warmth there. That's where they can survive. So the cycle that begins is, what will happen is the monarch butterfly, the super generation, if we start from there, and they will travel down to this location in Mexico. And this is a tree that's just covered. And so ironically, or uniquely, I guess, is that they will migrate to about 30 to 45 feet off the ground on these trees. And that's a kind of a band of where they all live, because they found that that's the warmest spot, not up at the canopy, not down at the ground, but this is the most convenient spot for the butterfly. And they will just, in the thousands upon thousands, they will attach themselves to this tree. And so around February, so around this time of the year, they're going to start heading back north. Now, up until this time, they have been non-reproductive, because it allows them to save on energy. It allows them to live the winter in Mexico. But along this trip on the way back up, they will become reproductive again. And as they travel, They'll get up to somewhere in Texas, and that's about as far as they can make it, and they've lived their life. And so now this generation will start laying their eggs on the underside of a milkweed, and this whole process will start over. But that means that the generation born there in Texas now has a new challenge. They have to know that they have to travel on farther north to a place that they've never been, and they don't know how to get there. But they are going north. So the next three or four generations have to make this step. They only live for about 4 weeks on average, and so they're going to make themselves this travel as it goes up north. And they have to get all the way up there, and about the time they get there, the new cycle begins. So now we have a new generation of super monarch that's going to travel back south and return to the same place in Mexico. Okay. If we move farther south, like really farther south, to where the emperor penguins live. So this is going to be one of the harshest environments. And so these penguins are native to Antarctica. That's just where they live. So an average emperor penguin is going to stand about 4 feet tall and weigh somewhere between 60 and 90 pounds. They've been known to dive as deep as 1,500 feet and hold their breath for over 30 minutes. So as they live here, again, Antarctica is one of the harshest conditions. It's not uncommon for the temperatures to get to minus 50 degrees below zero. It winds of over 120 miles an hour. Very, very harsh conditions. But the penguin, it has two layers of feather. It has an outer, stiffer layer, and it has a very downy underlayer to keep it warm. It has a thick layer of blubber, and then they are able to maintain, at these temperatures, they're able to maintain a body temperature of about 100 degrees. So in that kind of a condition, they're able to do this. When they get into these extreme temperatures, the penguins will do what they call huddling. And so this is where they group together, and it can number into the hundreds and even into the thousands. And it's been known that, or it's been witnessed, that some of these, when they get into the center, will start to overheat. You're thinking it's 50 degrees below zero and it's getting hot out. And so they'll work their way to the outside, and they'll expand themselves to try and cool off, and they'll eat snow. They're able to live in these conditions. So if we think of a bird like a robin or a blackbird or a crow, that their bones are hollow. It makes it lighter and easier for them to fly. But the penguin is just the opposite. The penguin has solid bones. And this gives them their ability to, one of their abilities to swim, because they're not fighting the buoyancy of that hollow bone, but because it's solid, it allows them to dive deeper and have more control. They're living on, essentially all the time, they're living on ice, and so their feet have blood flowing through them to help keep them warm. Again, you have an animal, you have a bird, it's living in a very harsh condition, but it's doing it each and every year for generation after generation. If we continue on this thought on the emperor penguin, so the female will lay one egg. And so they are seasonally monogamous. I guess how I would phrase that. Seasonal monogamous. And so the female will lay one egg, and she will transfer that egg to the male. And so he will balance it on his feet for somewhere between 60 to 75 days while he incubates it. During this time, during this almost 2 months, if the egg touches the ground, within minutes, the chick will freeze and they will lose it. So the egg cannot stand being left out in the atmosphere, or out in the elements, for very long at all. So the female will head out to sea to feed. And she'll return at about the right time that the chick is ready to hatch. And so during this time, she will eat almost 200 pounds of krill and fish. But because of the energy she's using doing this, when she comes back, she will have only gained 15 or 20 pounds. She's gone for this right amount of time, and she will come back and she will find her mate who has the egg that she transferred to. So if we look at the male has a special brooded pouch on the underside, and this pouch is right above his feet, and it's where he keeps the egg, and for all this time, he will hold it there. Now, we talked about the feathers and the down. In this one little section, there is no feather, but there's a high blood flow rate, and in that blood flow, it helps keep that egg warm, and it'll keep that egg at almost 100 degrees, allowing it to incubate. So for the next 5 to 6 months, the parents or the chicks are reliant upon the parents. So the mother comes back in time for the chick to hatch, and she will begin feeding him while the male goes out and he feeds and he comes back, and they just alternate back and forth for the next 5 or 6 months to keep this chick alive. So then we have the eye. So we all have them. They're about an inch in diameter. And so a fingerprint has approximately 9 distinct features that they use when they're trying to determine whose fingerprint this is. Whereas the human eye has over 250 features that they can pull from. The eye is one of the most complicated parts of the human body. It's second only to the brain in complexity. So we have our lens on the front, which takes in, and it actually inverts the signal and puts it onto, and gives it to the back, where the optic nerve is now going to take this. And there's almost a million nerve fibers that go from the eye up into the brain to transfer this information. And so from the optic, so what we see that gets projected on the back of our eye are optic receptors. And there's somewhere between 125 and 130 million photoreceptors. So we think of, as we buy a new phone, it's got a 48 megapixel, or whatever, 100 megapixel. This is the clarity that the eye has. It has a ratio, or has a resolution of 125 million. That it can break that down into to get it back to the brain. And so we can see the complexity of this. Our eyes see red, green, and blue. But that allows us to see over 10 million different shades of color. And the lens of the eye is one of the few body parts that do not have blood vessels. So it has to actually get its oxygen from its environment, so that around us. So it receives it from just being exposed. So there are two different muscles two different muscle sets of muscles, excuse me, that are used to constrict the pupil or to open the pupil. And then the fact that we have two eyes is what allows us to have a greater peripheral vision, but then also to be able to see in three dimensions. Gives us that perspective. Even though it's not very far apart, it allows us to see that in a three-dimensional state. So for me, the question became, we ask ourselves, what gives the butterfly that intelligence to have a super generation? Say, okay, guys, you're the next one. You're going to be a super generation. And each year make that trip south and know where to go so that they don't freeze and their species can continue. How is it that the penguin is designed to handle such harsh conditions and not freeze early on? As we think of how it's able to keep the egg warm, how it's able to transfer that egg from one to the other and not let it freeze in that brief moment of time. And how does the eye work so perfectly with the brain that allows us to see as we look around and we are exposed to what God shows us in the world? How is it that it works so perfectly? So the question becomes, what do we do with the information? So this is essentially, here's some facts, and you could pick a lot of things in nature. But what do we do with this information? So we might say there's two answers. I'm going to propose that there's a third answer here in just a moment, and I'll explain what that is. But if you believe in evolution, eventually at some point in time you have to get back to there has to have been something created from nothing. So how can that happen? So, and this is a model that that they use for evolution, and they show the time, and this one is at 3.7 billion years. So whether it's millions or billions, or if they even ever get into the trillions, at some point in time you have to get back and say, where did this come from? So physicist Stephen Hawking once proposed, because gravity exists, now it must be noted that the definition of gravity is the force that attracts one body towards another physical body having mass. So that's the physicist's definition of gravity. You have two objects that are attracted to each other. That's what causes gravity. We all have it, but it's so small amongst us, it's not until you get into planet size that you see that it really makes a difference. But Stephen Hawking's response was, because gravity exists, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. You're going to take two things of nothing, and they're going to attract to each other. I don't understand that. I haven't been able to resolve that statement. And so many physicists are taking this approach. This is what he said. Two things that don't exist will attract to each other. We believe in creation. It'll show us that the details that is in each item and point to a creator. Just like those three items that we just described, the butterfly, the penguin, and the eye. The complexity of each, the way that it knows things, the ways that it can travel, the way that it can survive. Creation points to organization and a purpose. So from the other side, they may ask, well, where did God come from? Which I think is a valid question. We ask the question, where did nothing come from? Or where did something come from nothing? But where did God come from? And I have two responses for that. So the first one is, we don't know because God didn't reveal that to us. What was before time? I don't know. But Anyone or anything that's affected by time, space, or matter is restricted. If you're restricted, then therefore, by definition, you can't be God. So if we look at that, we think there has to be time, space, and matter. We look at Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, there's time. Genesis. In the beginning, so there's time. God created the heavens, there's space, and the earth. There's matter. All three of them have to be in existence at the same time. So looking at that evidence, what makes sense of how we came to be? To believe in creation is to believe in God. John 14 in verse 6, so this has been in the recent studies here in the auditorium class. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So if we go back to the previous one and say we believe in God, and Jesus says he is the way, then we can only follow his way. A couple examples might be the rich young ruler. He came to him and says, what must I do to have eternal life? I've done this, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. And Jesus says, sell all you have and give it to the poor and come follow me. It wasn't because he had money, but it was because it was his attitude towards the money. And the man wouldn't give it up. He was this close to Jesus. He couldn't give that last little bit. Jesus says, I am the way. You have to come to the Father. You have to do it through me. But another man we might think of is Simon the sorcerer. He came and he witnessed the apostles' teaching, or I guess it was Philip's teaching. And he wanted to buy that. He wanted to buy that power. He told him, your money perishes with you. You can't do this. Then you can't buy that. No, you need to correct yourselves. And that was Simon's response. Please make it that this isn't so. Let me repent. Let me get myself right with God. Whatever it is that God wants me to do, that's what I need to do. Earlier in that same chapter of John, John 14, Jesus says, believe in God, believe also in me. I will go away and I will return. Excuse me, that's 1 through 3. I've condensed it, but that's what he's telling them here, is that I'm going to go away, but I will return. Now, the key thing to remember here is this is just before the crucifixion. So in the next 12 to 18 hours, the disciples are going to witness Jesus dying on the cross. He's saying, I want you to believe in me. You may see something. You may witness something. Believe what it is that I'm telling you. What is it that I'm saying is going to trump anything that you see? Because I'm telling you, I'm coming back. I'm going to be back. And you're going to witness me dying. That same chapter, going down to verse 15. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. We need to believe in him. We need to trust him. Trust him more than what we trust in ourselves. And we need to keep his commandments. So I mentioned that there, you know, evolution and creation, and that that's really your two choices. But here recently, there's become a third one that's becoming concerning. The group is called the Nones, N-O-N-E-S. And it's growing, especially those among the Gen Zs. So a nun is someone who says, I don't have any religious affiliation. I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. I don't care how we got here. I don't care if it's through creation. I don't care if it's through evolution. It's just not important to me. But I ask for someone to really look at that. We ask ourselves, what side do I want to be on? What makes sense is I look around the world and say, I see all this stuff. How could this be? But where is it that you will put your trust? So Proverbs 3, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and he will make straight your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. Trust in God. So Dave read us John chapter 1, 1 through 4. And I'd like to read that again. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. Without him, nothing was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and life was the light of men. Where do we put our trust? What does the evidence that we look around see show us? How can this be? You could pick anything in nature. You could pick anything. And I'm sure you can dig into it and say, there just can't be a way that this was spontaneous or by accident. You can look at this and say, this shows order, this shows creation, this shows a creator. And now, am I following the creator? Am I doing what he's asking me to do? The creator said, we've fallen, I'm going to send my son. Earlier, we partook of the Lord's Supper. He did this so he gave himself for us. He wants us to be with him. He's presenting himself to us. So this morning, I ask that you examine the evidence and say, am I following God? Who am I putting my trust in? If you have a need, I ask that you come forward as we stand and sing.